No dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 31 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes on the Commentist Network at thecommentist.com. And you can reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we'll find out where in the world Andy is, follow up new developments in the Cafe Gratitude scandal, answer a listener question, and then we'll be joined by Rama Ganesan to learn about her journey from vivisector to vegan, after which she will join us in asking the question, does nonviolent communication make good vegan advocacy? Whew, that was a long question.
Nailed it.
So Andy, we actually have a nice connection in the places that we're about to talk about. Not that we went to the same place, which would have been very possible, but where did you go to eat?
It's a rare occasion that we're in the same place. I treasure it. upon entering Connecticut, the very first place I went to was Shandell's, which is in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which if anyone listened to episode one of the show when we talked about our top five vegan or vegan-friendly spots in Connecticut, Shandell's was my number one. And they are all vegan. It's kind of Ital Jamaican-type food. And you walk in. It's always Shandell behind the counter. He's very nice. He's there every day they're open, even on his birthday, because he loves doing what he does. So
yeah, that's nice.
Super nice guy. And it's one of those situations where there's like 12 different dishes made and you get a large plate, you get six of those dishes. And I just love it so very, very much. And I was glad to be back in Connecticut, if only for getting that sweet Shandell's.
And I have never been to Shandell's still, somehow.
Even though Bridgeport is not. We need to fix that. Maybe on the way to New York.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And I was also at a vegan Jamaican restaurant, similar style, where you kind of get a large plate. They put on five of the different dishes. There's, I don't know, 12 dishes, probably about the same, that you can choose from. It's called Fire and Spice. It's in Hartford. I actually live right near it, and I hadn't been there in about a year, and I went twice, like within a week, and it was, I went back.
You're a monster.
I went there, and I was like, all right. This is what I forgot how good this was. I need to go back immediately. And I went back 2 days later and it was still as great. Staff, super, super nice. Just like a nice warm place. They had some, I got a dessert. It was like a peanut butter and jelly cupcake. That was very good. So, they got really great food. Always good. Fire and Spice.
The Connecticut, end. Connecticut holding it down for the vegan Jamaican options.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
And that's not even the only one. There's also, is there still Lion's Den in Hartford?
Never even heard of that.
Nope. Maybe we'll make a trip sometime.
Yeah. All right. So that's where Andy and I have been eating at. Now let's follow up on the Cafe Gratitude scandal that we brought up last episode.
Yeah. And we say scandal in quotation marks because we couldn't think of a better word to describe it. But it's there's been some developments. There's been some escalation. There's been reports of death threats being received by Matthew and Terzi Zengelhardt. And so if you want to hear a big old discussion about this, check out last episode, episode 30. But essentially, the owners of Cafe Gratitude and also Gracias Madre, they're 40-year vegetarians, and they co-own a farm. And on that farm, which provides a lot of the produce for those restaurants, they have some animals and have apparently decided to send those animals off to slaughter and consume their flesh and their bone broth and also sell it to other people. And so, understandably, a lot of people are not excited about that development. And
I think saying not excited is a bit of an understatement.
They're pretty pissed off about it. And so we wanted to just follow up because there was a article in HollywoodReporter.com, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes at thecommentist.com. And in it, it's interesting because Matthew Engelhart offers some more defense of what's going on. And they also kind of reveal that they've been receiving death threats. Now, who knows what death threats are, if that's like a letter scrawled in blood it's like sent to them, or if that's just someone on Facebook that's like, you should die because of this. Either way, probably not the coolest thing to do in this situation, but people are definitely very heated. So anyway, from that Hollywood Reporter article, people have taken up the mob mentality, says Matthew. It saddens me that the choices we made in the privacy of our home would lead people to feel so betrayed that it's elevated to threats on our lives. I'm very discouraged. So before we even get any further, I found that quote was kind of interesting because he's kind of just reducing the slaughter and the death of an animal before their time to a personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
So that always kind of irks me just a little bit.
Yeah, especially as a like 40-year vegan, it seems like, I don't know, it seems like that's the kind of stuff that you wouldn't say at that point. And especially because like Andy always refers to it as like consuming animal flesh, and he referred to it as that. I think in the last episode when we read that article, he says like, oh, I've decided after 40 years to start like consuming animal flesh or something like that. I know he used that phrase. So you're right. It does still surprise me that he would say stuff like this or a personal choice, or like we talked about last episode, how he's saying like, oh, we don't want these animals to go to waste. It's like that kind of stuff that you're like, after 40 years, that never came up, and you never kind of like had to debunk that for another meat eater.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very odd. And we kind of last week talked about the distinction between the business and their personal life, and how is it necessarily fair to punish their businesses, which are for the most part vegan. I would, you know, people just call them plant-based because at least one of them does serve honey. But is it fair to punish this outlet, which is serving mostly plant-based food to a ton of people? They say 28,000 meals a week in all their enterprises. Is it fair to punish those things for their personal choices? So it's like, I think that is an interesting question, but I do feel like it's really faulty on his part to boil it down to just a personal choice. Mm-hmm. It's not like people are mad that he's like, you know what? I'm switching after 40 years from creamy peanut butter to chunky peanut butter, making this personal choice for myself. And everyone's like upset about it. It's like, we've decided to kill these animals after, you know, and they've been figureheads for many people within the whole food plant-based movement. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so the article goes on to say.
I was also going to say, it's also interesting that he uses that. I mean, he doesn't use the word personal choice, but he does use like the choices in the private of our own home. So he is kind of implying that. And that's interesting to me because in his initial defense of it, he made a more compelling, in quotes, argument for why he's doing it, where he's like, oh, it's because like we're bringing these cows on because it's helping with the agriculture and it's better for the environment and it's actually killing less animals than these kind of like monoculture plows. So it's like he made a better argument there, and now he's just kind of saying, oh, it's a personal choice.
Yeah, very, very kind of a flimsy defense in that regard, I would say. But anyway, so the article goes on to say, for their part, the Engelharts professed to be perplexed by the dissent. I don't think there's any organization on the planet that's done more to promote a plant-based diet than us, says Matthew. We've moved it from a dogma to a genre. We serve 28,000 meals a week in all of our enterprises. We've done nothing but a plant-based diet at all our restaurants, and we're being attacked. It doesn't make sense to me.
So I think I like, I feel for him on this front, except for the, I don't think there's any organization that's done more to promote a plant-based diet. That is a bold claim. That is a very bold claim. I'd love to see him go off with Gary Yourofsky about who's better for the animals.
And also, I think Bruce Friedrich about John Mackey and Whole Foods, because he made the claim that no one's done more for animals than Whole Foods has. So
all three of them can
There's a couple contenders in the ring.
Like, I do agree that, I mean, 28,000 meals, even just having one vegan establishment, let alone three almost vegan establishments, it's like, that's big. That's very important for the vegan movement. So I do feel him on that I can see why he's very perplexed by this, this backlash.
But I mean, how could he not have expected this? Like I get that he, in his mindset, he's like, I have done so much for this cause. Why are people attacking me? But it's like, you're doing something that is counter to this very cause. Yeah. So while he may, I feel like maybe be in the right, on some level to say it's unfair considering how much he's done and how little people are attempting to sort of reconcile why they're doing it. But I don't think you should be surprised whatsoever that people are upset since they've been talking about living vegetarian for 40 years. Yeah. And sort of, in their mind at least, creating this movement and making it mainstream. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know. And, I mean, I don't really know how much credit they deserve. but you know, just to be like, we're just going to throw this out the window and we're just going to start slaughtering animals.
Yeah, I guess.
And actually, you mentioned three establishments. And last week I said that Sage Vegan Bistro was one of their restaurants. And I do need to actually issue a correction on that because it is not owned by the Engelharts. It is owned by their daughter, Molly. And also, according to this article, Woody Harrelson is also a co-owner.
Yeah. He's vegan though, right?
Yeah.
So that makes, yeah. I guess that kind of makes sense.
I like that Woody. Yeah. Anyway, and so she just says that she purchases almonds and peaches from Bee Love Farm. So, and she's like, I don't want anything to do with this. So maybe she shouldn't be quite as wrapped up in it. Although.
Is she wrapped up in this?
I mean, people like, yeah, because earlier reports were listing Sage as one of the three restaurants being owned. And so anyway, so that's a little correction there.
Can't we all just be decent, man?
I just want to sit on ass and watch some movies, Paul, and review them angrily. Anyway, the last thing that I'll read from this article is the Engelharts, who met while attending Landmark Forum, which, side note, is essentially a cult. There's a lot of reporting on that. And there's been a lot of issues with Cafe Gratitude forcing their employees to, like, check out the cult, basically, without getting into the whole thing. And they've been some lawsuits about forcing people to pool tips, which was illegal. And so there's, like, a lot of reasons to not support Cafe Gratitude above and beyond this thing. But anyway, the Engelharts, who met while attending Landmark Forum, believe they're being held up to a dogmatic purity standard, one that, in the scheme of their contributions to veganism, is entirely unfair. Somehow we got made mom and dad of some vegan movement, says Matthew. We never signed up for that. It's crazy. Do the protesters check in on the diets of every vegan restaurant owner? Do they check in on the diets of the owners of Whole Foods? Yes, they do, actually. We've had whole episodes about it. But we are baffled. And believe me, there are a lot of vegan enterprises where the principals are not vegan, or they have other enterprises that are not vegan. He goes on, I am allowed to change my mind. And by the way, I never told them what my mind was. All I told them was it's a vegan restaurant, and it still is, and it always will be.
Sounds like a grumpy old man.
not happy with what's going on.
And I will say, I agree with a lot of the things that he says. It's like the fact that he made the change is what's making people upset. It's like there are tons, like he said, there are tons of vegan restaurants that I love that I'm positive that the people aren't vegan that own it. And it's like, that doesn't upset me. You know, it's like, I'm like, oh, I got this vegan establishment and I don't really care about the person that, well, I care about them, but I don't really care about the person that is owning the place, like what their diet is, or if they're vegan. So it is interesting. And I'm not saying that it's unexpected, because like you kind of said, it's like, it is to be expected, but is it, like, justify, is this all this rage justifiable, I guess? Because it's like, it almost seems, I don't know if I want to use the word hypocritical, but like he said, it's like, where are people doing this with other, I mean, Whole Foods, but where are people having this kind of scrutiny in a lot of other restaurants?
Yeah. And I think that, like, isolated, the rage is justifiable because animals are now dying at the hands of someone else. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there was previously an ally to the animals. So I feel like that in and of itself, the rage is justified. But it's like, look at all the people out in the world that are eating animals every day from, like, far worse establishments. And not that there's any nice way to kill animals, but you know, the people that are complicit in this all the time. And I get that it's different because these are people that were, like, you know, allies for such a long time, and people felt like they were, you know, quote unquote on our side, and now they've switched teams. So, like, I get that. That sucks. And it's a bummer when someone that you know and love and trust, mm-hmm, stops being vegan. But in the grand scheme of things, if they're not converting their restaurants to be vegan, it's like, yeah, I'm not sure if the rage towards the restaurants and them because of the place they hold in the movement is entirely justified, even though I feel it. You know, like I totally feel it.
And I want you to tell me, Andy, I want you to tell me, punk, what is the end goal in boycotting their restaurants? Because one, I don't think it's going, like, this backlash against them is, I, especially after seeing his response, I don't believe is going to make, like, the, and I'm not just saying, like, people being angry, but people, like, sending death threats, people boycotting and stuff like that, like, that sort of emotional backlash is not going to make him become vegan again. It's like, that's not the conversation, I don't believe, that's going to make him say, like, oh, you're right, I was wrong. Like, people start, like, I'm going to kill you. Oh, you're right, I'm going to stop, I'm going to start being vegan again. I don't think that that's going to happen. And two, if the, like, why are they boycotting? Because it's like, if the restaurant gets closed down, I feel like that'd be terrible. It's like, why would you want, despite who the owner is, I shouldn't say that, but given these circumstances, why would you want the entire restaurant shut down? It's like something that's providing, like they say, 28,000 vegan meals a week, all of a sudden, like, not available anymore. I feel like that is a blow to the vegan movement, not really helping it out. Just to kind of get back at, like, one person, you know?
Yeah.
Or two people.
Yeah.
Maybe three. if Molly gets involved in this.
Yeah. It's like, maybe the end game is, like, sending a message to others. It's kind of like, hey, other vegan business owners, if you turn your back on these, you know, morals you're professing, this is what's going to happen to you.
But I feel like that's just going to make them be like, so I'm not going to start a vegan restaurant, because it's like, I'm being held to this level of scrutiny that other restaurants or other owners, business owners aren't being held to.
Yeah. And I mean, this response really ties in perfectly with the topic that we're going to be discussing later in the show. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to dig into that and hopefully tie it in. Yeah. But yeah, it just, as much as this whole thing bothers me, the way the vegan community is reacting feels off to me. It feels counterproductive.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, I don't really understand what the end goal is. Like, I feel like the end goal should be to get these two people to go back to being vegan, and I don't see how, like, a lot of the steps that are being taken, aka death threats and boycotting, are going to get them to go back to being vegan.
Yeah.
Especially if these people were vegan or vegetarian for 40 years, I don't think, like, an emotional response like this is, you know, it's like there had to have been some thought on their part that went into this. I don't think it was just like, oh, I really missed hamburgers. Like, one day they were like, I really missed hamburgers. Okay, I'm going to break vegan, blah, 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 blah. Like, I don't think that's what it is. Obviously, there was some thought that had to have gone in this. And therefore, there would have to be some productive discussion and thought from people who are vegan back on them, and be like, hey, like, think about what you're doing. Let me make these points, blah, 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 blah. And, like, I feel like that would be the way that would get them back on track.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, let's leave it there. And let's move in to answer a question that we got from Rose. You might be familiar as Rose as the artist behind our first ever fan art. Talked about her last week. But I got a question from Rose that we wanted to answer, which says, as someone who probably meets up with or follows a lot of vegans, what do you do when someone you generally like supports others you generally dislike? I unfollowed a vegan I like's blog because apparently they met up with and support two vegans who I'm not going to name because I don't want to give them any extra press, but they're highly problematic fitness vegans. It makes me so sad to do it, but I just can't deal with them being those two fitness prominent YouTube bloggers. So is this something that's happened to you where there's been like someone that creates content that you really like, and then they repost something from somebody you're like, really? Like Yourofsky or whatever?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Occasionally I'll see people posting from Yourofsky, especially friends of mine that have recently gone vegan will sometimes post his stuff. And I'll usually just be like, hey, like, just to let you know, this guy is a terrible, terrible person. Now, I'll, like, say, hey, just so you know, this guy has, like, a lot of problematic views, and he says a lot of problematic stuff, and he says some really bad stuff, and I'll give off a few examples and stuff like that. And most of the time, if I phrase things like that, again, this is if this is in the situation where it's like a newer vegan who maybe saw his saw the greatest speech that's ever been made video, and are like really behind it, and maybe that's the only thing they've seen from him. And for the most part, they'll respond and be like, "Oh shit, you're right," and delete that post. But I mean, there are also people that, you know, are like really into people like Gary Yourofsky and others, who like know about these issues and kind of look past them for the most part, for the reason that, quote, they've done so much for the animals. And I'll just try to write something engaging them in a discussion about why they should not be supporting him. I was trying to think of another example, because there was something that happened recently where, yeah, again, it was just someone that posted something like kind of racist, and it was nothing to do with the vegan movement, but just on like their Instagram. So I, like, you know, I'd sent them a direct message. I was like, "Hey, by the way, blah, 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 blah," sent them an article, and they responded like, "Oh, okay. Like, thank you for sending me this article." That was kind of the end of it. So it's like, hopefully something happened with them, but who knows if they just said, "Okay, I'm not reading this asshole's article." Yeah. But I don't know. You know, it's like I try to do something and I try not to like attack the person, because I'm sure if they're posting this kind of stuff, I'm sure someone has attacked them for it before. And I just don't think, for me at least, I don't think that that's going to be the thing that gets through to them. And because of that, I try to take like a different approach and just try not to attack them. And we'll talk more about this in our interview. But what about you, Andy?
Yeah, I think less so with personal friends and more so with people that are more, you know, putting out content for others. I think that's kind of more what the question's getting at. Yeah, although
I just did not answer the question at all.
although it was maybe left a little bit vague. But yeah, it's I guess one, I would say don't feel bad ever about not following, like unfollowing someone because you don't like they're supporting something or they're putting out content, reblogging stuff from others that you don't like. I think that much like our episode where we talked about, you know, should you put out good content from otherwise or from, you know, good content from problematic people, there's kind of a scale to be had there. And to me, it's like, you know, how much do I like this person? Is what they put out, you know, their original content not problematic at all? And, you know, how bad is the person that they are supporting, and have they been sort of questioned on it or called on it, and how did they respond? Mm-hmm. So, and like, honestly, that's in many situations, how someone responds to being called out or called in, you know, politely, you know, mentioned about something. I think how someone responds to those situations is a lot more telling about if you want to be, you know, friends with them, mm-hmm. or follow them, than them posting that bad thing in the first place. Are they willing to listen to you? Are they willing to hear you out? If you do send them, like Paul was saying, a very polite message, something that's not like, you know, screw you, this is the worst person ever, like, you're not going to get a positive response back from that. People are going to be defensive even if they're wrong. Mm-hmm. So if you do try and approach it in a constructive way and you just get someone that totally blows you off, like, I feel like you should feel totally justified in not following that person anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, there's I can think of a few, I don't follow a ton of, you know, YouTube channels or anything. I can think of one that I really like, and this person makes great content that I think is really good for new vegans and, people that are considering going vegan, really easily breaks down these issues. They're also a fan of and support, a handful of people that I find to be incredibly problematic. So for that reason, I follow, but I don't ever really reblog their stuff. I try not to promote that person as much as possible, because as far as I know, they have been sort of, that has been called to their attention, and they just don't give it much credence. But I still like to sort of keep an eye on what they're doing, because I think that they provide really useful information. So that's kind of my compromise in that situation. But I don't think you should feel that there's anything wrong with, you know, if you're just really disappointed in someone that you're following, you know, if they're not conducting themselves or their activism the way you like, I don't think you should feel anything wrong about not following them anymore.
Yeah, Yeah, we'll put Andy.
All right. So with that said, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Rama Ganesan, and we will have an interview and then a discussion about the question, is nonviolent communication effective vegan activism?
Hey, it's Paul here from the Bearded Vegans. We're just taking a quick break to tell you about The Commentist.
TheComentist.com.
.com.
That's the one. .com. What can you find there, Paul?
You can find a lot of great podcasts. We got, of course, The Bearded Vegans. So you can stream our episodes there if for whatever reason they are not on iTunes or Stitcher. You can stream our episodes. You can leave comments and comments on there. You can listen to the other.
Wait, are you telling me you can leave comments and comments? It's the only thing you can do there.
You can listen to a lot of the other great shows. There's Roll to Hit. That's a Dungeons & Dragons podcast. There's Kiss the Crest. That's a soccer podcast. There's The Unwind. That's a technology podcast. And we're adding a couple new ones. So check it out. Keep going on there. You can leave comments. TheCommentist.com, the place for comments.
All right, let's get back to the show. All right, our guest today is Rama Ganesan, who we brought on to discuss her article, Is Nonviolent Communication Effective Vegan Advocacy? Rama, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Cool. And so before we actually start to talk about that article, we just want to learn a little bit more about you. And I noticed that in your bio at the end of the article, it said that you are a former vivisector. So seems like quite a journey from vivisector to vegan. So, you know, what did your vegan journey look like?
Right. So I was, definitely a vivisectionist. I learned how to be an animal experimenter back in college. So about 19, 20 years old. Impressionable age, where, you know, you really want to do well and do what other people tell you to do is smart and good and scientific. I went on to do a PhD as well. And I continue to do research in labs for all of my 20s. So almost all the way up until I was 30. And that was actually quite a long time ago. So it's true that I used to be a vivisectionist, but the last experiment I did was the end of 1992, okay? So that was a long time ago. So in some ways, I think of myself as being a completely different person now. Mm-hmm. But the reason I like to mention that is I can really understand when I see these videos of people in factory farms or slaughter truck drivers, or even slaughterhouse workers, but that a little bit less. I can kind of understand why they are doing what they're doing. When there's one video that really brought this to mind is turkeys are in trucks and going to be slaughtered, and they're like roughly taking all the turkeys and throwing them in, and you think, oh, how can they do that? These are sentient beings. How can they do that? But I've been in a lab, and for those workers, these are units to be processed, okay? And for me, it was the same. The animals were data points, and I was supposed to get a certain number of data points in a day, and I had to be efficient, and I had to do this. And so I can understand how they're thinking and working that way. So if somebody like that can have a change and think differently, that's meaningful. So that's why I like to mention it. But I'm not one of those people who has nightmares about what I did. That's lucky. I know I've got in front of me Michael Slusher's book. They All Had Eyes. I bought it like a while ago. I looked at it, but I'm nervous to really get into it. And I know he has said that he has nightmares. And so mm-hmm. he wrote this book to try to resolve some of that. But I'm not there. I mean, and that's a good thing. I do feel very bad, but I'm not in a position where I'm really, losing sleep and can't, you know, feeling really bad about it. I'm not there. I like skirt around the edges of feeling bad, and then I'm okay. So that's lucky.
Oh yeah, I actually just picked up that book, and I'm also kind of dreading reading it, although I feel like it will be a really interesting perspective to take in.
Uh-huh. And some of what he's writing about, some of the scientific hypotheses, and like various combinations of lipids and growth hormone formula. You know, it's like I just so identify with that. So, yeah.
Cool. And so at what point did you start to become aware of what veganism was? How did that click for you? What did that look like?
All right. So my son was accepted into Duke University a few years ago, and their freshman reading, they have a common reading for all the incoming freshmen. And the reading for him was Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. Mm-hmm. So he read the book, and my daughter, who's a couple years younger than him, she read the book, and I read the book. So we all read the book together, and that was when it began, when I started to really understand what was going on. And it took about several months to a year of doing research, really thinking about animal issues, animal rights issues, and I became a vegan. So about a year after that.
Wow. And so now you're involved with Ethical Choices Program as a humane educator.
That's right, yeah.
Tell us more about that and what that is, what that kind of work entails.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is a job that I've had for the last few weeks. It's going extremely well. So Ethical Choices Humane Educators go into high schools. We are trained to go into high schools and to make presentations on various aspects of animal use, specifically the ethics, you know, the inherent cruelty of it, also the consequences in terms of health and the environment. We tailor the presentations to different topics. And also they are tailored for the high school age, again, usually the freshman age for high schoolers.
Hmm. And what made you want to do that type of work as opposed to any other sort of outreach that you could do? Had you been previously doing anything else?
Yes, yeah. Right. So so I became a vegan like 3.5 years ago. So definitely I wanted to do something, some kind of outreach. I became familiar. I mean, I did some work with the Toronto Pig Save, the Save movement. That was more of research that I did for them. And I also became involved with Direct Action Everywhere. So for a long time, those were the only two choices that I knew about as far as what can we do for kind of grassroots activism when you're actually talking to, you know, the real world. I mean, I think a lot of people write and make podcasts like you. I mean, not a lot, some do. I mean, a podcast, I mean, your podcast is for vegans already, or mostly people who heard about what veganism is. But I think, you know, real activism is kind of talking to people who've never heard of veganism, you know, who don't know what it is, and introduce those issues to them. So I guess from a sales point of view, it would be like the very early stages of getting them aware of what's going on. So that's the kind of thing I wanted to do. But those were the only two kind of options. I was also new here when I came here a couple of years ago. But yeah, I was a participant in Direct Action Everywhere for a while. For me, I'm much happier doing what I'm doing now. In fact, ECP, I am thrilled with what we are able to accomplish. What is the difference for me? I mean, I think DXE does do great stuff. I am very happy they exist. I'm thrilled about some of the press coverage that they've had recently, over the last year or two, but particularly recently. So I am happy they exist. But for me, it was a lot of wheel spinning, a lot of effort that was unproductive. You don't know if a disruption is actually going to work out or it's even going to go through, whether it's going to reach the right audience. Not only are we annoying non-vegans, which DXE says it's, you know, it's not our job to be popular, but we're also annoying vegans as well. And a lot of energy goes into justifying the tactics with other vegans. And again, I am I would say I am sold on some of Wayne Hsiung's ideas, or most of them. I think they are good ideas. But these are the problems that I had personally for me. It was a lot of unproductive effort, which I wanted to do something where I felt I was really reaching people. Like if I go to a school, whether the class is 10, 20, or luckily, you know, maybe 50 or 100 if it's an auditorium, I am talking to those kids. I mean, they are listening to me and I am getting through to them. So there's nothing about that that is unproductive.
That's a really cool program. I actually teach high school myself, and I would love to see if, do you know if it's in Connecticut at all?
I'll look, you know, if you go to our website, the Ethical Choices program, it'll tell you we might have, right now Ethical Choices has 30 humane educators, mostly around the East. So Connecticut is a very good possibility. But some of the Midwest and the Southwest is not covered. But they are going to hire more educators by the beginning of next school year. So the fall, we should have about 60
awesome.
People. So ECP is both here in the U.S. and a little bit in Canada, but they're also hoping to expand to other countries as well. I mean, the wonderful thing about this is, you know, a disruption is, you know, what is, it's annoying. And you, it's meant to be annoying, but it is annoying. And to some extent, they'll say you're not yelling, but I was yelling on street corners. But this, when you frame it as education, you are invited into the classroom. Mm-hmm. So, I've only started just now, but some of the other educators who've been doing it for a while, they get invited back again for the next semester.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a totally different way of framing the message. So, you know, if I could do this, why would I personally myself do something else, you know, that I didn't feel was productive?
Definitely. There's certainly a stark contrast between those two types of activism, for sure, which is a perfect segue into the main topic that we wanted to talk about. And you wrote this article, you know, asking if nonviolent communication principles could be applied to our vegan advocacy work and what exactly that would entail, and would we feel that it's being effective and all of these things. So we want to kind of mine that. And I guess Before we even lay out how it could apply to vegan outreach, could you just explain for those that are not familiar what nonviolent communication is?
Sure. So nonviolent communication is a program that was created by Marshall Rosenberg, I would say, you know, mostly 80s, 90s. Now, he's been doing this work intensively in various parts of the world, including some war-torn areas as well, to bring some peace and to mediate between different factions. But it's basically a program to improve communications between people.
And so the nonviolent communication is something that's like fairly new to me, even though reading through what exactly it was, there's a lot of things that I was like, oh, I do that. But there's a lot of things that I was like, I do not do that. And that might be hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the vegan movement, obviously, there's so many different ways to do outreach and talk about the message. But I feel like in general, it kind of prides itself on being something that's like very rational and logic based, and we have the facts and the science and statistics on our side, and we can prove anyone wrong who disagrees with us. And nonviolent communication kind of takes a different approach. And so I just kind of want to work through the article and the different bullet points that you make and expand on those things. And the first one you make is that is don't judge non-vegans as wrong,
right?
Which it seems like a hard thing to do, because we are here because we believe that it is, you know, killing animals unnecessarily is wrong, and how do we not judge someone for doing that? So and that's like one of the many things. I know in the article you're kind of torn between some of these principles and like, does this really mean we can use these with our activism? But you know, why do you think it's important to judge non-vegans or to not judge non-vegans? And do you think it's even possible to do?
Yeah. So, you know, I wrote it to, in fact, so that people can, in fact, ask me questions like this and I can understand it more, because, you know, I thought, well, wait till I understand it better and then I can write about it. And then I would probably never get there. So it's by talking to other people that I hope I will get to understand it. So Yeah, I think since I wrote it, I've come more on the side of, yeah, you know what? This idea of not judging, it's really beginning to make sense to me. And this is the very thing that Marshall even starts to talk about, his book, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life. That's the very first chapter when he's talking about how we judge people. And I mean, you know, one example would be how vegans judge non-vegans or the use of animals. But he's talking about any type of judging. So let me put it in a way that Marshall doesn't put, Marshall Rosenberg does not put it this way, as far as I know. But let me put it this way. Do you know what the moral code of the universe is?
No.
I guess it might be do unto others, or it might be that there's no moral code, but
do unto others, right. I mean, that's about one I could come up with as well. But you know, do we know, is it written somewhere? No, all right, we can try to infer it. And I know there are reams and reams written by moral philosophers and now psychologists. So yeah, we can talk about that. But what I'm trying to get at is there is something we know for sure, and that is what we feel, or that we feel, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We know that we feel. So, but what we feel is another thing. To know what we're feeling, I think you really have to turn around and pay attention. And some of us don't, I mean, the way our society is doesn't really teach us how to do that or even approve of things like that. So we know what we feel, and then that those feelings are an indication of what our needs are. So I think that what you can be sure of, I don't know what the moral code of the universe is. I don't know. I mean, that is the case. I don't know. I could read the books, but even still, that would just be being up in my head and thinking about it. But what I do know is what I feel. So, and when we understand what's happening with animals, when we open our eyes to it, and we know, we feel, you know, that this is unjust, you know, we have, and this, we are saddened, heartbroken, heartsick. We have all these feelings, right? I mean, NVC has a list of feelings. So and these are some fundamental feelings that we have, and we can infer that we have certain needs, and our needs are to try to address those feelings in some way. And so, yeah.
I was going to say, this is, it reminds me of in a pretty recent episode, we looked at this article that was kind of making the argument that if like all atheists should be vegan. And it was the argument that it made was that if you're not, and this reminded me of it when you were talking about like, where do we get this universal moral code? And they were saying, well, if you're not getting the moral code from some higher power, then you have to be getting the moral code from logic, and everything is logical, and logic, if it made a bunch of like logical arguments that led towards veganism. And it's funny because this is such a stark contrast with nonviolent communication, where it's like they're saying your moral code is coming from logics, and yeah. Then and now this is kind of promoting more that it's coming from feelings, which
right.
is kind of cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know who you had on the program, but that's also something I've thought a lot about. You know, the atheism and vegan, you know, the new atheists and whether they should be vegan and whether Sam Harris should be vegan, things like that. So I've thought a lot about that, and I can, I don't think they, you know, well, we haven't been very successful in making Sam Harris go vegan. He's not very happy about it. even in the last AMA, and this is kind of what I predicted, but I'm not even happy about being right. But he starts off saying, I have a cold, probably because I'm on a vegetarian diet. So I don't know. So yeah, but I appreciate what you're saying, Paul. I hadn't realized that, but that's true. But from the NVC point of view, okay, mm-hmm. From the NVC point of view, that is what we have. I mean, we have observations, we have feelings, we have needs, and we can make requests. That's the NVC steps, that process that we follow.
And you in the article, there's the quote, judgments are said to be a reflection of unmet needs of one's own. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Right. Judgments of unmet needs of one's own. I can, yes. So let's just say that I mean, okay, so let's talk about veganism. So I have a need, you know, to these animals are like, I am sad and I'm very upset about this whole thing. And I can try to talk to people about it. I can express those feelings. And that's something we might want to address later. Not everybody can express feelings, because those are very vulnerable feelings, right? So I can talk about those things. I feel very comfortable saying I'm heartsick, or I'm depressed or distressed. I can, and I you know, I feel I'm crying. I can say all of these things. Not everybody can say that. And then they have to express themselves in some other way. I mean, they're going to have to turn around and blame somebody else or judge somebody else, because they can't get in touch with their own feelings. So judgments are, unmet needs of one's own. I mean, there could be various things. I mean, what I just mentioned is perhaps people aren't turning around and looking at their own feelings. It could be other things as well. You know, we want to be effective in our advocacy. We want to be understood is also another thing. If we're not getting there, then instead of looking at that need, we are judging somebody else, which is actually a block into getting in touch with our needs.
To back it up just a little bit, you're talking about Sam Harris and the AMA and being right and not necessarily feeling great about it. The next thing you kind of touch on in the article is to not focus on winning or being right or having the other person be wrong.
Right.
And that is, it's like something that feels great, you know, when you're like, I proved that person wrong, but it's always in the back of my head. It's like, is that really effective? And I have learned that, like, in my outreach, that, like, you can sort of just, like, just riddle someone with information and the truths, and, like, you can just, like, totally knock them out with all this, like, how wrong they are. But right. then they, and even in the moment, they might be like, oh, you're kind of right. But then they kind of get up and they dust it off, and the next day they're just like, that guy was a jerk, and they don't really like listen to what you have to say. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think when people have genuine questions, I think it's okay to explain. Sherry Kolb talks about this in her book. So, you know, she has 13 questions, and a couple that I can think off the top of my head are the plants have feelings one, and the one about, I think the other one is about abortion. So yeah, I mean, she goes into and she tells you what's going on in the mind of the non-vegan. And so when somebody says, do plants have feelings? And we hear it and I get so annoyed. but you know, sometimes they are really asking, you know, they really want to know how is it, well, we're not supposed to eat animals. Well, where do we draw the line? And so, you know, I just explain it. I'll say, well, you know, plants, they don't have nervous systems. They can't register pain. They don't have pain receptors. And furthermore, animals eat plants. So we, in fact, cause more plant cruelty, if you believe that plants feel pain, by eating animals that eat plants than eat the plants themselves. So, yeah, I actually explain that and people have thanked me. Okay, So I mean, I still get annoyed, but that's kind of what Sherry Kolb was saying in her book too. So you know, so I'm not saying it's wrong to really address the question if that's what they need. I guess the point is when you really feel like you have to, you know, beat the other person and prove that you're right. And you mentioned a little bit about that, Andy. You know, it's like, I want to come out of here victorious. And I really want to like squash that person and make them completely wrong. And I got one today who was totally annoying. Like I said, I was saying something like, oh, you know, I know why are people, this is another article that somebody else wrote about how cities need to, how will they become plant-based or abandon meat as they need to for the future. And this guy, and then I said, well, you know, I saw all these responses saying, oh my gosh, we can't give up meat. I was like, well, you know, we come from a culture that's vegetarian. So I can't even understand why, you know, I don't know why, well, I do know why it's hard, but I don't think it's hard personally to give up meat because I never ate meat. But I do understand how other people can feel that it's impossible not to eat meat. I mean, they grew up here in the USA. They have three or four meals. Each one of them has animal product. I mean, each one of them might even have meat. And then tell them to go vegan. They really don't know what to do. And, you know, even if they believe your arguments, which might even happen occasionally, they need a lot of handholding. And if I tell them to go look it up on the internet, they don't appreciate that. You know, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of vegans do, in fact, look things up and they just teach themselves. But on the other hand, others do need some sort of, you know, do this, do that, make this. So, you know, I've focused a lot or thinking more about doing real hands-on demonstrations, classes, you know, in my community. So because it looks to me that that's kind of something that people really do need. I think a lot of ways in which you're fighting with people, you say you go vegan, oh, you're not going to go vegan. They say, no, well, bye-bye. I don't want to talk to you anymore. Well, where do you go from that? You know, maybe they think about it, maybe they don't. But if you keep the lines of communication open, then you can occasionally tell them one thing or the other. You know, some of these things are going to directly benefit their health. So that's what I'm thinking about. When you're doing this question answer and you know, arguing and who's going to win and you beat somebody, you don't end up with a relationship, right?
Yeah.
And NVC is about relationship.
So when you're doing, like when you're working in the high schools, because I know, like all my students know that I'm vegan and they ask me questions a lot about it. And even if I'm not like trying to get them to go vegan, they always come at me with like the classic non-vegan arguments, like, oh, well, plants have feelings and all that kind of stuff. So I imagine that when you're working with the students, you use like a lot of these NVC kind of techniques. But if you only have like however long your presentation is and you're not necessarily able to make like a personal connection with the individual people, how do you kind of apply these theories in that situation?
Right. So there's two different questions. We can come back to you. So what I might suggest you do, yeah. I don't know. But with respect to what we do, we do presentations, 45 minutes, 90 minutes. And in fact, I've gotten these 70-minute presentations lately. And they are pretty fast-paced. I mean, they go through a lot of information. And almost all of the students, all the classes, I should say, have been very engaged. They all want to talk about it and ask a lot of questions. It's not like they're, but they're not really getting, nobody's asked me, do plants have feelings yet? In my presence, it could happen. I do get other things, like one person, as we start, he'll say, well, you know, we have to eat. And I say, yeah, hold on to that thought. And I'll come back to it, or you can ask me again later, because, you know, we do talk about this. You know, what else can we eat? So we get back to that. So yeah, I would say you're right. And we don't get asked a lot of questions. I mean, I do know that over time the educators have had different sorts of questions. And I'm thinking, what is there anything that would be really annoying? I don't know. In the classrooms, I have not been annoyed. I don't know why. I do not find anything about it annoying. I find everything about it a gift. So it's just great. it's not like the internet. So I go in there and I speak to them. I mean, there are some kids are extremely responsive. So far it's been great. I've just started, but so there could be more to. I've done 17 presentations so far. So we'll see. You know, it's fast. You know, like I've got a lot coming up over the next few weeks. So we'll see. But there was another thing that you said. I'm forgetting. So this is what I learned from NVC. And what they say is, so whatever questions, you know, we address the questions, but if they're still being very resistant, we'll say, well, we are here to educate you about the choices you have so you can make choices according to your own values, according to your own values. So, you know, we're here to educate you so that you can make choices according to your own values. Mm-hmm. So, and that's it. I mean, that's about all you can do. What are we going to do? Beat somebody over the head and make them go vegan? Is that the way to make, not just the students, but anybody, Sam yeah. Harris, anybody, you know, is that what we're going to do? So, and we say this, and I learned this from NBC, I'm sorry, I learned this from ECP. Somebody who says something very similar is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, you know, she says this in her the YouTube videos and her podcast. She says, I'm not asking you to act in accordance with my values. I'm asking you to act in accordance with your values. And the other thing about NVC, which also relates in here, is that things are always in terms of requests. It's never a demand. So it's always in terms of requests. So when I say, for example, I could say to myself, oh my God, I have a need for the world to go vegan. Okay. Now, when you think, but is that really a need? That's not a need. Do you know what that is?
a demand?
I'm not demanding. I'm saying it's a need, but what it is actually is a strategy. It's a strategy to get my needs met. So this is all NVC language, you know. So it's a strategy to get my needs met. So what are my needs? Well, my needs are for understanding and to live in a shared world, a shared reality with other human beings. I mean, vegans are, what, 1%, 1.5%, I don't know, 2% in the U.S., probably, well, I'm not sure elsewhere. It varies. So we're small. I mean, we can't really, I am part of humanity. I am not going to condemn everybody else. You know, I'm not going to condemn 99% of humanity. I'm part of humanity. I need to be part of humanity. So I have feelings. I try to determine what my needs are. I make requests, and that's about all I can do. And that's, I would say, all we can do. I mean, we can push for policy changes, right?
Yeah.
Down the road, and especially if we have more numbers. Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, you're part of humanity, and that kind of ties into one of the other principles of having empathy for non-vegans, and just sort of, you know, the very obvious statement that we were all, or most of us, were once non-vegans. And that's something that we kind of battle with on the show a little bit is, you know, the people that are saying, like, everyone who's not vegan should have this horrible thing done to them. And it's like, well, 8 years ago, that horrible thing would have had been done to me by this. And look where we are now, and it's possible for people to change. And do you have any, like, advice for how to feel that empathy when someone isn't being receptive to the message?
Well, let me say one thing about statements like that. And thankfully, I've never said anything that bad, but, you know, I know that other people have. But when you hear things like that, and I don't know whether you watch the video that of Melanie Joyce that I linked in my article. It's a kind of a long one, but really, it's worth watching or listening to. It's really very good. And she talks about trauma. So she says vegans like us and a lot of us have gone through a certain trauma. She calls it, what is it? Not PTSD, but secondary traumatic stress disorder. Okay. So it happens when you watch somebody else getting hurt. Okay. Secondary traumatic stress disorder. And I can even send you some information on that basis. So, and that really resonates with me. I definitely feel like I've been through some trauma, and it's because it's such a big thing that has happened to you and it's completely changed my life, you know, the last 3-4 years. And when I hear people say such things that you mentioned, I think they must have gone through trauma too, right? I mean, to come out with something like that, there must be a lot of hurt that those people are experiencing, which they're not turning in and looking on themselves. And they're just, you know, venting and they're looking in the wrong places to say, you know, I want all non-vegans to die a horrible death or, you know. So I think that's what I think. I think trauma. That profound disappointment with humanity and you know, having to be part of all this while complicit, or we were or still be part of humanity, which is complicit in this violence. That's traumatic. That's very hard. So that's what I think. I feel bad, and I understand why they would say things like that. But I don't know about advice because I am so working on this myself. it is so hard. But this is a problem that I have. Is you're always looking outwards and, you know, turn around and look at yourself and find out what your needs are and how you can address your own needs and help your own mourning process, having to come to terms that, you know, that what we have been part of and what the majority of humanity is still part of. So understanding, yeah, and you know, some of the examples that we've already talked about, I think really, you know, like the Sherry Kolb's examples, and that those are really good. I mean, and some of the examples that I talked about a little bit later in the article, you know, really think about why people would say such things. I mean, I'm talking about non-vegans. So, for example, I have vegetarian friends who will say, you know, they're not interested in hearing anymore about veganism. And that's something I said, oh, I don't understand them. I literally said, I don't understand them. And somebody else came along and they told me, a vegan told me, well, it's because they're okay with enslavement, but you know, because dairy and eggs don't really kill animals, they don't feel that they're part of killing. It doesn't necessarily have to involve killing. So that's the way in which they're thinking. And I mean, and that was interesting, and that helps me understand vegetarians who won't go, who are you know, ethical vegetarians, but they feel they don't need to go vegan. So yeah, I mean, I think that being able to understand or even just thinking about it is a huge step towards feeling less angry and resentful and hostile, because feeling angry and resentful and hostile is exhausting. You can't be a good advocate if you're feeling that way. Well, I can't say that. I can say I cannot be a good advocate feeling that way, and I cannot live my life feeling that way. So that is something that really does need to be addressed.
So what do you think we can do if we do know about like NVC and we know about how to kind of reflect upon ourselves? What can we do to like promote this with other vegans who maybe are saying these sort of things? And like you said, maybe they have some, like there's some things they need to work through themselves. Like what can we do?
Yeah. And and I also said this in the article. I mean, some of all, you know, this stuff that you mentioned is, does this happen in the real world or is it only on social media?
I think it happens in the real world. I mean, I think people are more comfortable putting it on social media, but I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I do. And I, maybe you're right. Cause I do a lot of this, the enemy image building, you know, I think about something, oh, why isn't she going vegan? And I talk to her about this and why isn't she vegan? So yeah. And I'm like totally like going through it, ruminating it over my head. I mean, and you know, the thing is, we can't even ask the non-vegans because they are so resistant and they have all this cognitive dissonance stuff and they have fortresses built up. You can't ask them to try to understand them because you can't even get anywhere close to them. I, even the ones that are people that I'm close to, and they're asking me for other favors, which is fantastic. But when it comes to things like dairy use, it's like, no, no. So what can you do? I think basically is to think, and I talk a little bit about this in the article too, is to think about what could be their motivations for acting that way. You know, ultimately, maybe it, you know, one of the things, you know, they have to admit that they have been wrong all their lives when they thought they were kind, you know, nice, wonderful people. This is all hard for them. And it's also, there are also a lot of, some people are afraid to go vegan because they don't know enough vegans. I mean, I never met any vegans until I became one. So for me, you know, I saw, somebody told me to watch Forks Over Knives and that was it, you know. And then I said, oh, great, fine. Then I have no qualms about going vegan. But others, they're afraid, you know, they think they're going to get sick. You know, they think they don't know enough. They don't see enough real vegans who are being healthy and thriving and living productive lives. There isn't enough of us around there.
Right. And yeah, you mentioned the enemy images, and in the article you say that they poison our minds. And I actually have a interesting story about that. I was on tour doing pay-per-view outreach. So people watch a video about the treatment of animals on farms. Afterwards, you talk to them. And my tour partner had gone to the bathroom. And so I was helping someone, you know, get set up on a screen. And the person was just like, I just want a dollar. You're not going to change my mind about anything. You know, for me, if I was to enter that conversation, my expectations would have been low. But my tour partner came back from the bathroom, like right as this person got off. And before I could go talk to them, she just jumped right into the conversation with the person and ended having a really great conversation because she didn't have that expectation that this person's not going to change. They don't want to change. They're just here for the dollar. And that sort of taught me to never, you know, to always assume that someone is going to want to go vegan after they learn about this information. Obviously, that doesn't always happen. Most of the time, it doesn't happen. But it feels like that's sort of the enemy image concept just put into action right there. That, like, if you go into a conversation expecting to have a positive experience, you're way more likely to have that positive experience. And I wonder if you've ever had anything like that happen, or if you could expand on the enemy image thing.
Sure. I mean, I an experience like that just happened to me recently. I mean, some people are so good, and it need not necessarily people. I mean, think about it. It's interesting. I mean, I would, and I didn't say this. I mean, and I should set as a disclaimer to begin with. The reason I'm studying NVC is because I am a person who is so easily incited into anger, you know, and like I say, a lot of the things I read on social media by other vegans just make me more angry with non-vegans, and it's contagious for me. So, and this is why reading things like NVC, I find it useful just so that I can try to implement some things that make me feel a little bit more comfortable in my own mind, and to go out and do calm and kind advocacy. So your question was about your question was about advocacy. Can you tell me what your question was again?
I was just wondering if you've experienced that the poisoning of the mind with the enemy image, and maybe you've talked to someone and not, you know, you've given them really low expectations because you assume that it's just not going to go well, or what your experience is with that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I know people who've watched all, you know, the movies that we tell them to watch. You know, they've watched Earthlings, they've watched Cowspiracy, they watch Forks Over Knives, but they won't go vegan. And then you get, you know, that's, and then you start thinking, what is going on? And are they are so willfully ignorant, and they're, you know, all kinds of ideas about them. And I can, but I can tell you there are other people that I've known who before, like, this person, she's a vegetarian. Well, why won't she go vegan? Why won't she do this? But then that same person that I'm still meeting with, and somehow completely dissolve that enemy image of her. And I see her as a great person who's doing great things. I really appreciate her. I think she's wonderful. So, you know, feeling that way about somebody, okay, she's not 100% vegan, but feeling that way about someone is so much better, not just way for me to live in my own mind, but also for her to be with me. I mean, obviously, she's going to like being with me if I think she's a wonderful person, and I do, you know. We're going to have a great relationship. We will have a relationship. So that's kind of what I'm aiming for. Sometimes I'm lucky and I've managed it, and other times I don't manage it, and I have to still keep working on it. But this is it. I mean, the enemy image can be dissolved. It can be. It does happen.
Another thing you mentioned is sort of it's a fundamental premise of NVC, that the needs of all humans are fundamentally benign. But it seems like you kind of struggle with if you think that's actually true or not.
Right. So, you know, you really have to understand what NVC means by needs. And, you know, there is a, it's, you know, you can look it up, and it says, you know, what are NVC needs? In fact, if you look it up in the book, and it'll tell you. I mean, we have needs. They are needs for autonomy, celebration, integrity, interdependence, play, spiritual communion, and physical nurturance. And those are it. Those are the fundamental categories of needs for NVC. And then there's other things that it could be, you know, there are subheadings. For example, interdependence could be acceptance, appreciation, closeness, community, consideration, contribution to the enrichment of life, to exercise one's power by giving that which contributes to life. So forth and so on. So these, you really have to understand what Marshall and the other NVC people are talking about in terms of what needs are. So, you know, as human beings, we are little specks, and, you know, we have a strong need to be connected to other human beings. We're not, you know, omniscient or omnipotent. We go around telling people what to do, and you have to do it. Sure. I mean, I think for the most part, I can see it. But I think it's the whole fundamental change in which we have to think about people, which, again, I really have to struggle with, because it's just not the way we're raised. It's not the way we're educated. It's not the way we communicate, or we're taught to communicate. So when I was writing the article, I learned more about how a fundamentally and radically different way NVC is to relate to the rest of the world or to yourself. So it really starts very deep down. So it's not like something you can just, it's not a superficial thing. So you really have to think deeply about it. So yeah, the fact that I struggle with it, of course, you know, it's that this is what Marshall would say is it's a totally different way of you know, for example, you grow up, you grow in school, right? You're supposed to be, you know, study and you're top of your class and you know, but Marshall says, well, the better way to do it is for the person who understands the student who understands something first is to explain it to the other person. You know, that's a better way to do it. And then we get rewarded and we get punished. For different, and that's the whole reward and punishment structure of society. He'll say that is not conducive to proper compassionate communication or fulfilling relationship. Okay, so the whole of our society is built on rewards and punishments.
Absolutely, and then sort of the big question I think with all of this, because a lot of it seems to make sense. Some of it at first is kind of like, huh, hadn't thought about that, but I think we can apply that to our outreach. But it also kind of feels like sometimes this stuff just sort of leads to moral subjectivity, mm-hmm. and the like just understanding the other person's needs and not judging them and all of these things. And it, and on some level, that almost seems like it's totally at odds with doing outreach or trying to influence change or get people to change or open their eyes to whatever issue it might be.
So, I mean, Marshall would say that this is the only way to accomplish social change. This is not an impediment to social change. This is the only way to really have sustained social change. Okay? So, I mean, he's Marshall and there's more to be, this is not explicit in his writings. I mean, he didn't actually write that much. I mean, he has three books, all of the three, I mean, that I've read. And he's got a lot of books in German, which I haven't, but I think they might say the same thing. So, but he, you know, he is obviously a big fan of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So he definitely believes in nonviolent social change. So nonviolent strategies for accomplishing social change. So he says that this is the only way it can happen. Yeah. So I think there's some part that I missed. So could you maybe ask me that question again?
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated question for sure. And just sort of, you know, pondering does this lead to moral subjectivity? And that leads to the question, is this good vegan advocacy? Which is okay. The question of the article.
It does sound a bit like that to me. And I've even talked to some NVC teachers who make it sound like moral relativism. But then those people could be confused about veganism. Okay, so there isn't any. What we need is a true vegan, and I think this could be out there. This person could be out there, a true vegan advocate or activist who practices NVC. Okay, and this is their number one priority. You know, so you know, vegan activism has to be the number one priority, not NVC. Vegan activism has to be the number one priority. We need that. So maybe you know, in this podcast or something else comes, you might find that person. Moral relativism. Well, look, the question is, do we believe the people's needs are all fundamentally benign, that we all want connection, that we're all inherently compassionate, we do not want to see other beings hurt, we do not want to see people hurt, we do not want to see non-humans be hurt, definitely not unnecessarily, and if that is the case, then I think that if those needs are there, then the strategy is clear, right? I mean, some things have to be cleared out of the way. Like, you know, we do not need to eat animals for protein, and we don't need milk for calcium. So those people have to understand that. But other than that, I think that once that way is cleared, that has to happen.
I have a question. Do you think that like the NVC animal advocacy is kind of at odds with a lot of what the mainstream advocacy that we see now is, kind of like what PETA's doing or what DXC is doing? Like, do you think that those two things would kind of butt heads with each other, or do you think that there'd be some way that these groups could adopt NVC without having to change like their entire, like the entirety of what they okay. do.
Well, I think I think it's probably more possible with some than others. PETA, I don't, you know, I mean, they don't even claim to be doing anything progressive. So to go to talk to PETA about NVC seems a little bit incongruent. But let's take somebody like NVC. I mean, I'm sorry, with DXC. So for example, DXC, for example, they have written. A lot of things they have said is aligned with NVC. They've written some things about restorative justice rather than retributive justice. You know, not punishment, but rehabilitating and with people. So I mean, those are pretty. You know, not rewarding and punishing, but you know, that's so it's very much aligned with NVC. But there are things that DXC says which don't fit. I mean, for example, Wayne Shung has written saying animal use is wrong. It is wrong to use animals, which is not as same thing as saying you're immoral, but for using animals. But within NVC language, it would still be violent language because it's still a kind of a judgment. I think that DXC is got some things that could be close. I mean, I do think the other things about DXC is a lot of people who do DXC are angry. Okay, they are using DXC, and I can say that from my own point of view as a way to vent their anger, and that would not be a good thing. It's probably not likely to be efficacious, but not everybody in DXC. I think some people have been, they're not angry at all. I mean, they do it because they believe that this is the way to do it, and they are great about it. And so they've had good outcomes. So I don't think that it applies to everybody. So yeah, DXC has some things in common. When you read some deeply into some of Gary Francione's work and some of his moderators previous moderators have written, there are things that are quite aligned with NVC, actually. When you read his five principles, they seem aligned with NVC. Now, I'm going to mess up trying to remember the five principles. But yeah, he'll say something like, we believe everybody can become vegan and people do care, things like that. You know, it's not, you know, you go in with a good attitude, people will make positive changes. So those things that they've written are really good and aligned. But then the way they go about doing things, social media, the memes that they put out, they don't seem to be aligned. So I'd say that there are very, very good things there, which I can probably send you some when I go look it up. But yeah, when I was reading through some of that, I saw some things that I thought were aligned. We have DXC, you've gone through Francione. Who else, PETA? Who else can we think about? I mean, yeah, I think a lot of other groups probably... some people who have been very judgmental individuals who've been judgmental. Some people who I consider vegan leaders, when they say something judgmental about non-vegans the Tyson CEO or they say something very negative, very judgmental, they're going to get a lot of positive feedbacks from vegans, current vegans. They're going to get likes and shares and things like that. So they're getting a lot of validation, okay? So these vegan leaders are getting a lot of validation from vegans for being judgmental about, you know, the CEO of Tyson or some other people, or even just other kind, maybe even people who ought to be vegan, like, you know, Bill McKibben ought to be vegan, you know, Naomi Klein ought to be vegan, so forth and so on. You know, the Dalai Lama has to be vegan. But you know, the rest of us who are not, I don't consider myself a vegan leader because I'm not leading other vegans. I'm talking to non-vegans. I'm talking to non-vegans and telling them about veganism. So if I use that same strategy, that's not going to work for me. Mm-hmm. It works for the vegan leaders who are talking to vegans. They're getting validation for that, but that's not working for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's something I struggle with my t-shirt company is kind of, there's been times when I've come up with like a message or a slogan and I'm like, oh, vegans will love that and they'll buy a ton of it. But is it just going to get them a pat on the back from other vegans? Is it not going to start a good conversation? I feel that that's sort of this echo chamber that happens within veganism a lot of the time.
Yep, the echo chamber is, yeah, it's scary, isn't it? That we're only talking to ourselves. You have to be careful.
And it's hard because sometimes I feel like getting your needs met means surrounding yourself with people who can understand that secondary trauma that everyone's going through. But also if you want to affect change, that means getting out in the world and dealing and talking to people and understanding and showing empathy for people that do not agree and are not already on board with veganism. And it's a tough line to walk.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think it's the real world is nicer than social media. I mean, the people I meet, I mean, they're not, I mean, like I was talking about, even today I was just writing something and he said, "Can you read?" "Yes, I can read. You know, I know how to read." You know, how rude. But I mean, nobody would say that to me in real life. You know, they wouldn't. So, I think that what you talked about is, you know, the way you summarized is exactly what I think. It is a process. So, you know, figuring out where to go right now, I feel great about what I'm doing. I think ECP is fabulous. I hope ECP continues to grow and do great things. But it's only one part of the puzzle. I mean, I hope DXE continues. I hope Francione continues. I think his work is great. I love his books. I've learned a lot. He's made so many things very clear. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that seems like a really good place to leave it off. How can people find more of your work? How can they connect with you? Any social media you would direct them to have positive interactions on?
Sure. I mean, obviously I'm moderating the things I do say on Facebook now. Cause I mean, I'm wondering, you know, what do people who are, I focus so much on other vegans, you know, what do my friends who are non-vegans think? So, I mean, those things are important. Yeah. So I'm on Facebook, Rama Ganesan on Facebook. I'm Rama Ganesan on Medium. Yeah, so I guess those are the two main places. That's pretty much where I am as far as social media is concerned. Of course, I'm a humane educator, so if anybody is a school teacher and around here, so but anyway, yeah, not just me, of course. Anybody who is any humane educator would be fabulous to have in your classroom.
Yeah, and what was the if people want to learn more about the Ethical Choices Program? Is there a website? I know you mentioned something earlier in the program, but what's that one more time?
Yeah, it's called Ethical Choices. Yeah, it's called ethicalchoicesprogram.org.
.org. All right. Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm right there too. So yeah, you can see me there. You can contact me from there.
All right. Fantastic. All right.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul and Andy. Nice talking with you.
All right, so that wraps up our interview with Rama. Again, we'll post the link so you can check out the article. And it was a really, I really enjoyed the article and the interview too. The interview is awesome, but I had never really heard of NVC before. So it's definitely something that I want to look more into. So I'm really glad not only that I read this article, but that we got to have her on the show. So that was really cool.
Absolutely. And we get a lot of people emailing us saying that listening to the show helps them sort of learn how to talk about these issues and how to be more effective in communicating. So we're trying to get more guests on that have sort of a lot to share in that regard and maybe even have differing opinions on how to be the most effective. But so look forward to more interviews covering these types of topics.
Yeah. Yeah. So Andy, what's coming up in your life?
Ooh, well, this weekend,
ooh boy,
Paul and I are going to pack up the van and head down to New York City, and we will both be behind the Compassion Company table at the New York City Veg Food Fest.
I'm so excited.
It's been a good 6-8 months or so since we've done a fest together, I think.
Probably more than that, because the last one or two I did was not with you. So.
Oh, yeah, very sad.
I know.
Tear. so that's May 7th and 8th, and then not a lot going on for the rest of the May, but June 4th, the Albany Veg Fest, I'll be there with Paul again. And then I got a ton of stuff coming up. You can check all the dates at CompassionCo.com, CompassionCO.com. But June 12th, I will be at the Asheville Vegan Fest in Asheville, North Carolina. So
cool.
Look out for those.
Look out for
me.
Say
hi. Look out for me. Beard. Big old smile.
So yeah, definitely come up, say hi. Tell us what you love. Tell us what you hate.
And yeah. And of course, please let us know what you thought of the episode. And you can reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. You can leave a comment at thecommentist.com. That's thecommentist.com. And of course, we have our Instagram as well. And you know how to find that.
All right. Got anything else? We are the Bearded Vegans.
Signing off. Hey, is this violence in the street? My brother's got no time to sleep. Said them can't find a job, 'cause they've got no credentials. Is this violence in the street? My brother's got no time to sleep. Said them can't find a job.